seems that they speak out of two sides of their mouth at the same time. And their number one objective...
Don't you!
Stop America!
Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Cold River Mountain Watch. Cold River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycroft, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
PC. If you're listening on some sort of mobile device, iOS, or smart that, or Android, whatever, then we recommend the apps from Stitcher,
by government.
From TuneIn Radio, and over at the Apple
at the expense of the many.
App Store, BluTunes, which,
which
Sal has told us works very, very well.
In one of the most societies.
Also, at headonradionetwork.com, a one-stop shop for all of your podcasting needs. There's a link to the archives there.
Well, the stock market has
away you'll go. And, of course, the ever-present, mentioned
the issue of oil. Decline in the price of oil.
PayPal interface. See, that's how we keep all of this going.
The
we try to raise $150 per evening.
Over
and I am proud to say that this evening, I mentioned it late yesterday,
it has gone
but it was too late for anybody
over the
to
last
really
of years.
Participate in it. I mentioned it late during
but
the program. Steve has put a $75 challenge
the
on the table, which will take care of fundraising for today.
The
because the way it works is he's willing to put up $75
most
if
of the rest of
everybody
us
else will put up some combination that results in $75. He will then double
retirement.
Your money. Yes.
By logging in
so that's,
the kind
that's
of
what
annuity,
we hope to accomplish
which is
going to
guarantee us
Titanic
a life
Tuesday evening, because it is, in fact, Titanic Tuesday.
We have reached the end of our program today.
Remember,
and
Titanic
lost track
Tuesday
of time
is reserved.
I'm sorry. It's 3 p.m.
For those truly
we
Titanic
really need to move out of here.
Manifestations
this is
of right-wing genius.
We'll be back tomorrow at our regular time. Thank you for listening. Be safe and thank
goodness
you.
Me. I got ahead of myself in the restart. Now, hopefully, we will not... No. Stop it. There we go. All better. I hope. Yeah, I forgot to stop Dr. Bill. Yeah, you'll have that. Oh, I'm off to a roaring start this evening. I threw the third switch, but forgot to... Yeah. I need a keeper. But Dr. Bill's audio should be gone now. Yay, thank you, Carol Baker. Fixed. So, Let's see. Where were we? Oh, yeah. $75 matching challenge on the table. Any combination of $75 winds up getting doubled by our friend Steve in New York City. Thank you very kindly, Steve, and that will take care of fundraising for this evening. So, you know, better done sooner rather than later. I was informed, I got a note today saying that the manumen, the wild rice, the first order of it, is in the mail to me. That premium remains on the table. $100 gets you a pound of wild rice gathered by the shores of Lake Superior in northern Wisconsin, the pristine waters that, you know, that a renegade, badass hillbilly wants to poison by creating a giant iron mine up there. Of course, ask anyone who's involved in the struggle up in Ashland and Iron Counties, and they'll tell you, no mine. Not going to be no mine. Ain't going to happen. But they say that because they work tirelessly to prevent it. So that is, as soon as it arrives, I'll be turning it around to those of you who have taken advantage of the premium. And the more, if you want more, there is a little more available. You know how that goes. $100 contribution gets you a pound of hand harvested wild rice, harvested in the same fashion as it has been over low, yea, verily, millennia, thousands of years. Okie doke. Just give me the address where you want it to be shipped in the PayPal note, if it's for you, it's for you. It's a gift, whatever. Just let me know. Okay. Anyway, it is Titanic Tuesday on the horn, and we reserve that for Titanic acts of right-wing idiocy. You may recall that Jim was the one who provided us with the impetus for the name Titanic Tuesday. He was listening to a 962nd tier right-wing blowhard blatherskate moron over in Beckley one day when one of his knuckle-walking, right-wing, mouth-breathing listeners called up and said, Steve, how come it is you reckon they is fossil clamfish in the rocks here in West Virginia? I done see them myself. They're right there in the rock. To which the 962nd tier right-wing blowhard idiot replied, well, caller, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plates. Mm-hmm. Yep. No word yet on the movement of the Titanic candy dish. So you see, you gotta be extra special stupid to get yourself a mention on Titanic Tuesday. You gotta be beyond your ordinary repig-licking right winger. You gotta be walking into closed door dumb when you get right down to it. And we have that. And some of these things feel like it's the days are merging one into the other as we run downhill toward the end of the year. And this is kind of one of those, at least our, you know, one of our early nominations. We could just as easily save this one for prayer meeting Wednesday, but I got a feeling we'll be up to our elbows in freaks then too. So yeah, let's go ahead and just nominate this individual for a Titanic Tuesday nod. This story comes from the Marion Star in Ohio Stan. Oh, wow, that is a nice crowd in the chat room. I'm finally there. Good evening, Anatole. Good evening, News Ninja Carol Baker. Good evening, Jeremy in Vermont. Good evening, Jug-a-Punch. Good evening, Lance. Good evening, Ricky Carmicide. Good evening, Ron. Good evening, Sentient Steve. Good evening, Texas T and Todd. And good evening to longtime Horn chat room moderators Lottie and Sparky, as well as Sparky's doppelganger, otherwise known only as Man Cave. No, our first nominee does, in fact, come from the region of Ohio Stan. And this is a rather younger Moran, Titanic wit. He's a high schooler. He's a high schooler who has, gone on strike. His name is Anthony Miller. He's a freshman at Harding High School. they named a yeah, I guess he came from Ohio, so yeah, they named a high school after Warren Gamaliel Harding. He was the low bar for which George W. Bush reached when attempting to become the worst president in American history. Warren Gamaliel Harding died in office, and that's how we got Calvin Coolidge. No sense going into the history of Warren Gamaliel Harding. You can look him up. Thank you, Jeremy. Tune in loud and clear now on with the program. Yeah, now that I've stopped screwing up. Right. So anyway, Anthony Miller at Warren Gamaliel Harding High School in Ohio Stan has gone on strike. There's a lot of things maybe, and you don't just immediately, no. There's a lot of things that a well-intentioned student might go on strike for in this country. Crumbling infrastructure, or maybe going to a school where they insist on teaching that Adam and Eve rode to church on Sundays on the back of a dinosaur, that kind of thing. Yeah, I could see that. Students went on strike in Colorado, didn't they, over the right-wing attempt to enforce stupidity on the curriculum? Yeah, yeah. Not for Anthony Miller. Oh, no. Anthony Miller, freshman at Warren Gamaliel Harding High School, is striking over, wait for it, sure, the Ten Commandments. Of course! You see, back in 1953, the graduating senior class of Harding High School donated a plaque to dear alma mater WGHHS, I had to sort that out, of the Ten Commandments. And the Ten Commandments plaque hung right there on the wall where it belongs, at least according to the Texas educational authorities, next to the preamble to the Constitution. You might want to check out Dr. Bill's program from previously this afternoon, as he happened to be talking about the preamble to the Constitution. But it hung right there. And over the summer, I guess, the superintendent of schools there in the Marion City School District of Marion, Ohio, realized that the Ten Commandments hanging there was probably a lawsuit waiting to happen, because it is. So they decided to pull the Ten Commandments plaque, which was the, everybody, right thing to do. He said, we wanted to make sure our resources are directly aligned to our district's mission and vision, and that being to improve academic achievement, to improve our district culture, communication within our district, and to make sure we are using tax dollars wisely. With the understanding that it is not using tax dollars wisely to buy yourself a lawsuit and spend tens and hundreds of thousands of dollars paying lawyers to defend a suit that you are going to freaking lose. So, you know, little golf clap to Marion City School District Superintendent Gary Barber for getting it right. I guess we could call this an early program note. Somewhere around January the 5th, in fact, on January the 5th, we probably won't be on the air with a live program. That's Monday, January the 5th. And I think it's fitting, because on Monday, January the 5th, I'm actually going to be across the river at the Fayette County Board of Education, where they want to institute, I'm not kidding, a moment of silence. Mm-hmm. So instead of talking about morans, I will be confronting one, or several of them. Let's see, you might actually enjoy this. Here's the moment of silence resolution they want to pass over across the river. One, purpose. The Fayette County Board of Education sets forth this policy to establish a daily moment of silence at all public schools in Fayette County. Two, moment of silence. 2.1. All public schools, you know, you let the little fundies learn how to put bullet points in a Word document, and the next thing you know, here you go. 2.1. All public schools in Fayette County shall observe a 1 minute moment of silence during the school day. 2.2. Teachers and other school employees may neither encourage nor discourage students from praying during a moment of silence. 3. Severability. We had to look that one up in the name of Jesus. If any provision of this policy or the application thereof to any person or circumstance is held invalid, such invalidity shall not affect other provisions or applications of this policy. Praise God. Okay, I added the in the name of Jesus and praise God's, but the rest of it, no, they really did that. I like 2.2 the best myself. That's my favorite. Because what happens if you've got a little Buddhist child who has to, and I watched a video earlier today of Anderson Cooper going to a mindfulness, no, not mindlessness, mindfulness weekend seminar where he had to take his shoes off and couldn't talk and had to be all quiet and stuff. And there was a little scene of everybody sitting in a circle with their legs crossed and, you know, contemplating the right, and every now and then the meditation leader would ting with a little tiny pair of like little tiny Buddhist symbols, ting. Well, what happens if the precious lumpkin happens to be Buddhist and has to ting with their little bells during the moment of silence? And for that matter, how can a teacher encourage or discourage praying if they're being silent about it? On the other hand, what if young Cletus Jr. is suddenly slain in the spirit and begins to rolling on the floor and hollering for his pet snake and frothing at the mouth and speaking in tongues? Not very silent anymore, is it? Ting. So that's where I'm going to be on January the 5th. Hopefully I will be, there will be a program on January the 6th, as I will not have been arrested. Anyway, back to Marion, Ohio. Where is Marion, Ohio? I don't know. Yeah, see, there we go, Carol Baker. Can the Buddhist chant during the moment of silence? Well, if the Buddhist can't chant, then the teacher would be discouraging the Buddhist from praying and thereby violating the law. You see what? Really, these are titanic intellects. Oh, a good idea, Todd, in the chat room. Bob, take your cowbell. Maybe every time I say a sentence, I'll have to ring it for Buddha. Or maybe, no, you know what? I'll ring the cowbell for Huitzilopochtli. Okay? Yeah, I'm liking that a lot. Anyway, back to Marion, Ohio. So apparently all of his short and not particularly intelligent life, young Anthony Miller has been eagerly awaiting his opportunity to begin matriculating through the halls of dear old WGHHS, and it all came to naught when he walked through the hallowed halls and realized that the sacred Ten Commandments plaque was no longer there.
Really?
Yeah. And that's when young Anthony Miller decided he was a going on strike. He said, "I'm attending class because by law I have to attend class, but I'm refusing to participate. I'm aware of the consequences, but I would like to get my point across. I don't care about my grades now. I told the principal until there is an agreement reached, I will not participate in any Harding-related activities, any Marion City Schools-related activities, sports, choir classes, whatever. I won't even wear my Harding marching band T-shirt." That's hard. That's the one that got him. Wait, what? Young Anthony Miller will no longer wear his Harding marching band T-shirt? We've got to do something. Titanic intellect. He's gonna keep on with his strike until they put that plaque back up there where God and Jeebus wants it to be.
Until there's at least some agreement made between the administration and the students. If it's all year, then it's all year.
Principal Kirk Konecki, Konecke, said he's going to meet with Miller and other concerned students. Their concerns. They're concern trolls. Who are they? Yeah. Right. Of course, this kid is just looking for an opportunity, looking for a lawsuit, really. Hey, this is America. You got to get creative about paying for college. It's not like this is Germany or Scandinavia where you just get to go to college if you're smart enough and nobody hands you a bill. Please. That leads to socialism. Sadly, one of the classes, and I don't even know, I mean, it's 2014, right? Sadly, one of the classes he may be missing is civics. But that's okay, because he already knows everything he needs to know about the founding of America and how government works. Government works by prayer. And just because... it might be worthwhile reviewing the Ten Commandments at this point in time. This is what is so important that it's worth him not doing his homework over. I'd prefer he would hold his breath until he turned blue, but oh well. I am the Lord thy. Wait, I'm gonna do this right. I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt have no other gods, no graven images or likenesses. Wait, likenesses? I'm pretty sure young Anthony Miller is watching the television, which is just a steady stream of likenesses. nor wait. Not take the Lord's name in vain.
I hate that.
Remember the Sabbath day.
What day was the Sabbath day? Is it Tuesday?
You didn't remember the Sabbath day. Honor thy father and thy mother.
Anthony, darling, would you do your homework, please?
No, mother. For I am on strike until they return the Ten Commandments to Warren G. Harding High School in Marion, Ohio. Thou shalt not kill.
Isn't it interesting? You got to get all the way down to more than halfway through the Ten Commandments before you get to a substantive one that actually matters a damn. Yeah. Of course, I'm sure young Anthony Miller is, I mean, come on. Wingnut much? I'm sure this... Wouldn't it be fun to ask young Anthony Miller how he feels about torture?
Thou shalt not commit adultery.
Somehow I don't think we have to worry about that with a ninth grader.
Thou shalt not steal.
Okay.
Thou shalt not bear false witness.
Anybody want to bet that if you sit down and start talking to young Anthony Miller, he'll start babbling that BS about how, well, the framers of the Constitution was all Baptist Christian, Bible-believing, upstanding, God-fearing, had a personal relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ. At which point, lightning bolt. And then there's the whole part about not coveting his neighbor's ass. And that needs to be in a school, of course, along with the moment of silence. Yeah, there you go, Lottie, pointing out, in reality, in the Bible, there are no Ten Commandments. There's just a string of gibberish that can be interpreted as either 8 or 12 rules, depending on what edition of the Bible you have. Yeah. Like I said, I think we're going to be off to a rousing start here. So we got that. Irish Dave noting, I don't have to tell you, Bob, that the real Malloy has an actual Tibetan temple bell and is from Ohio, too, also. Oh, my. So, let's see. So we got that. And how about a little update on this Titanic Tuesday from the Department of Hypocrisy? My senator, Joe Manchin, is upset. No, really. He's kind of pissed off. Joe Manchin is upset with Dr. Tom Coburn of Oklahoma Stan. Joe Manchin is upset with Dr. Tom Coburn of Oklahoma Stan because Dr. Tom Coburn of Oklahoma Stan stopped the uh, the bill that would work to try to address the almost epidemic levels of suicide among military veterans. Now, of course, we can take this moment to note that one good way to stop suicide among military veterans is to not send them to illegal wars that make them come home and feel like they probably have done something horrible. I realize, way too simple, yeah. But no, Joe Manchin is mad at Tom Coburn because Tom Coburn, in an attempt to, with everybody else in the Senate going, yeah, okay, this is fine by me, there was a bill, the House had already passed the bill. It authorized $22 million to hire more psychiatrists in VA facilities throughout the country and to take a considered look at how the VA works in terms of trying to prevent suicide. Reasonable, right? Sound good to you? Sounds good to me. I mean, I kind of like the idea of our veterans not committing suicide. But Tom Coburn said, no, screw you, we need more veteran suicides, because Tom Coburn is, in fact, a repiglickin. He did this under hiding behind the skirts of fiscal responsibility. We are talking, of course, about the Clay Hunt SAV bill. It had a huge support among veterans groups. It had huge support among non-veterans groups. It had Republican support. It had Democratic support. It was actually bipartisan. And it was $22 million itsy bitsy dollars as compared with a more than $1 trillion bill under consideration. Never mind, Tom Coburn said, I'm going to be objecting to this bill because it actually throws money away. I don't think this bill's going to do one thing to change what's happening. So we just have to take Tom Coburn's word on it. And when there, you know, when the suicide epidemic persists, he'll just, see, I told you. Well, this is where Joe Manchin comes in. Joe Manchin was invited, for reasons passing strange, onto Mrs. Greenspan's program on MSNBC. Where he said, I'm disappointed. My heart bleeds for all of you. If for some reason we can't work this out today, I can assure you we will come back immediately with the next Congress, the 114th, and that will be our first priority. Oh, that's a knee slapper. Oh, he is a witty one. 114th Congress ain't gonna do squat. I don't know, maybe they'll pass this. I don't see it. Now, why is Joe Manchin a hypocrite? Why do I mention this story? Sounds like Joe Manchin's doing the right thing, doesn't it? It's the right side of the bill. It's the correct... Because I don't have to explain this, right? He's a hypocrite because he was one of Democratic votes against Dr. Vivek Murthy for Surgeon General of the United States. Joe Manchin voted against Dr. Vivek Murthy for Surgeon General of the United States, ostensibly because Dr. Vivek Murthy had in the past noted that we should probably consider it a public health problem when little Cletus Jr. gets his red, white, and blue Cricket 22 child's rifle out and blows away little baby Marveline. Because that happens. Dr. Murphy thinks we should consider firearms violence as a public health problem. Mainly because it is one. That was something up with which Joe Manchin would not put. Now, to be fair, other people have said that that's the reason. I couldn't help noticing that Dr. Vivek Murthy was a little darker than the color of your average brown paper shopping bag. Which made me remember how Joe Manchin scuttled the nomination of a man nominated to be the head of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, who also was not sufficiently pale enough to suit Joe Manchin. Right? Mm-hmm. So here's your sign, right? Ron and Raleigh with a note. Hey, Bob, when Charlton Heston stumbled down off Mount Sinai, he told Joshua that God's law was written with the finger of God just before he chucked them down on the gathered nation of Israel and killed a bunch of them. Soylent commandments are people, my friend, right? Yeah, as Anatole notes in the chat room, Vivek Murthy is probably the single most qualified Surgeon General we've ever had. Therefore, Joe Manchin must vote against him. You know, the upside, though, is that Dr. Murthy is going to be Surgeon General. The downside is that our veterans are going to continue offing themselves because they, among other reasons, don't have access to appropriate mental health care through the VA. Because the promise that we make to people who sign up with the military is that should they be injured in the course of their service to their country, that we will take care of them after. But, you know, Tom Coburn had his fingers crossed behind his back. Gotcha. Yeah. So any chance to include Joe Manchin in Titanic Tuesday or Moran Monday or Thorn in the Side Thursday is always a welcome one. We're still waiting for him to switch sides and be the Republican we all know that he is, and he knows he is, and God knows he is, but nothing yet, no. Note coming in from Tim. Correct me if I'm wrong, but when Jesus died and rose from the dead, Christians claim that there's a new covenant, so eating pork, shellfish, combining foods, wearing your Dacron cotton polyester blend, that's all A-okay. Well, if there's a new covenant, then the Ten Commandments are no longer required except for you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, and you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Obviously, murder, stealing, and lying are all criminal offenses, and adultery is a civil offense, so six of the Ten Commandments are now null and void because of zombie Jesus, correct? Right. Well, no, not really, because Jesus isn't really consistent throughout the Gospels there, Tim. Sometimes he says one thing, and sometimes he says another directly in contravention of it, and that has something to do with the fact that the Gospels are not biography, but rather hagiography. Because there's that other line about, you know, I did not come to do away with the law, I came to fulfill it. Like I said, there's a lot of those places. Oh, yeah. Let's wander over to Talibandiana, where, because capitalism, because money, there's a new T-shirt you can buy. There's a company there called South Bend Uniform that's run by a place called Jason Barthel. Jason Barthel is also a police officer. And Jason Barthel knows an opportunity to make a buck when he sees one. Jason Barthel is apparently tired of hearing hearing all of those melanin enhanced people and their friends walking around saying, "I can't breathe." So he's offering a brand new T-shirt. It's black, and it's got a big kind of, remember the badge on Dragnet, you know, sort of ellipsoidal, ovoid in shape, right? It's got a big star in the middle. And the message on the T-shirt is, breathe easy. Don't break the law. Yeah, no, really. Breathe easy. Don't break the law. Now, when WSBT contacted him, he said, "We're not here to do anything negative to the public. We're here to protect the public, and we want you to breathe easy, knowing that the police are here to be with you and for you and protect you. For those upset, please understand, when we use the slogan, breathe easy, we are referring to knowing the police are there for you. The police are here to protect and serve 99.9% of us, have the greater good in our hearts each time we strap on our uniforms and duty belts." I didn't know you had to strap the uniforms on. "We are all one people, and this is by no means a slam on Eric Garner or his family. God rest his soul." Yeah, then take the damn stupid T-shirt off the market. "Well, I wouldn't make a buck then." Oh, okay. Of course, I got just the way that news stories work out in terms of the way they circulate and timing and everything. I'm sure that Jason Barthel, owner of South Bend Uniform in South Bend, Tallahassee, I'm sure that he had no idea that the Supreme Court was going to issue that ruling by an 8-1 margin, no less, yesterday, that noted that the police only have to reasonably think they understand the law that they're trying to enforce before they throw you against the hood of a car, knock you to the ground, and taser you twice. Because it sort of takes all the starch out of that, we're here to be with you and for you and protect you. Because I don't think Mr., what was his name, Pete Vasquez, down in Victoria, Texas, I don't think he felt like he was being either protected or served when 23-year-old Nathaniel, that was his name, wasn't it, Nathaniel Holland, was brutalizing him. Breathe easy. Jesus. This, of course, is what you get on a Titanic Tuesday. One of the side effects of the cases of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and Tamir Rice is that it has brought older cases of law enforcement abuse bubbling back to the surface. One of those cases comes out of Key West, Florida, Stan. it's the story. It's the story of Gary Lee Lovett and Henry Del Valle, two police officers down there at the end of the eastern side of the continent. Lovett is going to get a 5-day suspension without pay. Yeah. And Del Valle has received a letter of reprimand regarding an unauthorized vehicle pursuit. Mm-hmm. After they killed a guy. This via the Free Thought Project. The case is older, but the internal investigation by the Key West Police Department has been completed, and there will be no criminal charges for either Del Valle or Lovett, Gary Lee Lovett, in the death of 61-year-old Charles Elmers. It was just these things happen, right? Sure.
Key West cops smother 61-year-old man during traffic stop. It looks as if Key West police murdered a Michigan retiree during a traffic stop last November and then staged a cover-up by falsifying a police report. According to the report, Charles Imers, 61, pulled away from a traffic stop by the Pizza Hut on North Roosevelt Boulevard and drove all the way to South Beach at the Atlantic end of Duval Street. He violently resisted arrest and fled the scene. Running to a beach where he collapsed, officers found him with no pulse. The police said Imers collapsed suddenly and died from a pre-existing condition. The local hospital concurred. No autopsy was performed, and Imers' body was sent to a funeral home, where it was almost cremated. Tissue samples from the hospital were destroyed. Then this video, shot by a passerby, surfaced. It shows Imers getting out of his car and voluntarily lying face down on the ground as officers approach him with their guns drawn. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement is now investigating the incident. According to a preliminary autopsy report, Imers had 10 fractured ribs. The neurons in his brain had turned red due to lack of oxygen. His trachea was abnormally red, and his lungs showed signs of tissue damage. This could indicate that Imers was roughed up by police and smothered in the sand. Looks like the good old boy networking keep...
Yeah. One of the police officers, that would be Gary Lee Lovett, said, "I dropped like a fucking bomb on his head. I tased a motherfucker in custody today. I don't care. I got to call my PBA rep when you kill someone." Yeah, I already called him. Yeah. His son, and it's not Elmers, it's Imers. Trevor Imers said, "I watched the video and I had no words. Everything that I was told while I was here was a lie. He was murdered by those officers." There's a problem in this country. And it's a problem that's not going away. And like torture, it's a problem that a plurality, if not a majority, thinks isn't a problem. How about that? What is it? Just over 50% of Americans surveyed think that, we're with Dick Cheney on it. Sometimes you just have to torture somebody to death to get it out of your system. Ron and Raleigh noting, as far as the Breathe Easy t-shirt is concerned, Keep selling it. I want them to keep selling that T-shirt, because then I can spot the racists. Sergi wants to know, are the top brass of the Key West Police Department going to provide Band-Aids and ointment to those two cops? Slaps on the wrist can hurt. Signed, Sergi. Owie, Kyle. Owie! Yeah. Oh, good God. So, as you can see, like I said, Titanic Tuesday. Lots of potential here. Never mind the war on Christmas. Apparently, there is now a war on Elizabeth Warren. She had the nerve to stand up in the Senate and talk with her woman mouth about, and she talked bad about our God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christian banks, what almost destroyed America. Enter Melissa Francis from Fox News TV Radio Rwanda Business Network. She slipped across the hall from the Business Network over to the main ward in Bedlam there to have a conversation with rising lunatic Andrea Tanteros. You don't remember Andrea. Eric Holder runs the Department of Justice like the Black Panthers. That Andrea Tanteros. Do let's check in, shall we?
All right. On the left, meantime, Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren insisted she's not running for president, saying it four times in an interview, but only in the present tense, which political insiders say leaves the door open for a potential 2016 campaign.
And it also leaves open a potential 2012 campaign as well, because she didn't say it in the past tense either, Andrea. She didn't say, I was not running, or I did not run, or I have not run, or I had not run, or I will not have run. Oh, my goodness, she's inscrutable, that Elizabeth Warren. You know, she's the problem, according to Lindsey Graham. Marcy says she is. She's the problem. I mean, if she was to run for the president, well, then my buddies there in them all-male clubs wouldn't be able to come to the White House now. And what fun would that be? Help me, John.
There's also growing speculation about when Hillary Clinton could jump into the race and how her timing might impact Warren, other potential candidates, and her own campaign. Now, she's reportedly planning an announcement in the spring, but the Christian Science Monitor writes, quote, as long as Clinton is waiting in the wings and not an announced candidate, that could give heart to the draft Warren movement, creating a dynamic that hurts Clinton, even if it doesn't cost her the nomination. And so in the end, perhaps Clinton announces sooner than spring.
And all of that means exactly what? I mean, I kept listening for words, but all I heard was blah, 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 blah. Just some Christian Science reporter, writer, Christian Science Monitor reporter, writer, sort of speculating wildly all over some paper or some screen monitor stuff. Yeah, not a lot of dipped quill pens out there scratching away on the parchment anymore. What do you got for us, Andrea?
Harris, I can tell you, whenever they speak in the present tense, candidates, or when I used to as a press secretary, you're saying, oh, we're in the race today, even if you're going to drop out tomorrow.
And certainly with the development today with Jeb Bush, I think that one of the two of these women have got to start to think about what they're going to do, because it really does come down to money. Democrats are going to put their money behind somebody, and don't you want to be there early to scoop it up? I think this is really interesting, though. Quinnipiac University took a temperature reading, which is something they do early on. This was back in March, and they looked at how people felt the temperature of these two women were.
Mm-hmm. Huh? Why is he this high?
They asked what people felt the temperature of the... Look, I'm just going to have to buy some more swirly straws. I admit it, I can't find the other one. you know, as has been alluded to just now in the chat room, taking temperature readings is not really something you want to be talking about within a week of the torture report being released and what it kind of has to say about, you know.
Let's see. Warren got a 63.9 degrees, and Hillary Clinton got a 78.7 degrees.
What? They're both dead! I mean, human body temperature is what, 98.6? You get down around 63, 78, stuff like that. I mean, maybe maybe they can revive you, but that's, you know, Iceman found in the Alps temperature. No, what?
What does that mean? That means the kind of the heat in the race. It really is a temperature. Like, which one?
Really? Really? Fox? The women are in heat? You know, they'd never let Steve Doocy and Brian Kilmeade do that story.
Which one do you think is hotter?
That has to have shifted since March.
So, yes. And so,
sometimes I feel sorry for poor old Emery and Marvelline sitting there in their Barca loungers. Emery, I don't want to hear you talking about Elizabeth Warren or that Clinton woman being hot, okay? Hey, we've been married for 72 years here. Oh, Marvelline, you'll always be the hot one to me. Yeah, get over here.
Now I'm curious. Yeah. Can we get another Q rating on that?
Yeah.
Can we get another poll on that? I'm really curious to see what the new reading is.
And I think you're right, because given the environment right now, I think Elizabeth Warren is going to capitalize on, you know, not only her economic populism, but also the social justice aspect. And if you noticed, all of the senators who are potentially running for president, they all voted no on the Cromnibus. Mm-hmm. And she was one of those people that wanted to put the kibosh, not because it was too much spending, but because it whittled down Dodd-Frank.
No, and she really came out smelling like a rose. I mean, she was the one.
Wait, stop. Okay. I didn't issue the hockey puck warning. Hockey puck warning. Duct tape, please. So, we now know that Elizabeth Warren is hot and smells like a rose and has had her temperature taken. Wow. So I'm not gonna interrupt. We're just gonna back up for just a few seconds and okay, go.
And if you noticed, all of the senators who are potentially running for president, they all voted no on the Cromnibus. Mm-hmm. And she was one of those people that wanted to put the kibosh, not because it was too much spending, but because it whittled down Dodd-Frank.
No, and she really came out smelling like a rose. I mean, she was the one that said this is a big gift to Wall Street. And I can tell you from talking to people in the financial industry, in banking, on Wall Street, they think she is actually the devil. I mean, without question.
Well, of course she's the devil. She's hot, and she has an abnormally unhuman temperature and smells like roses. I mean, isn't that the definition of the devil? Wall Street thinks she's the devil. That's okay, because a lot of us think Wall Street is, pretty Luciferian ourselves.
Warren is the devil. So they're going to put any money that they have behind Hillary Clinton, which should be a help, but it'll be interesting to see, because she's capitalizing on this moment in time, Elizabeth
but
Warren.
But it's populist, Bernie. It's populist. I mean, I have to give Elizabeth Warren some credit. She's running against giving the big banks some break for their derivatives. I mean,
we can all get behind that.
I know, but boil that down to a soundbite, Melissa. That's a political winner.
We all hate the banks because of what happened 4 or 5 years ago.
No, we don't. Speak for yourself.
Okay, I'll speak for myself. I like what you...
Wow, okay, so... The woman in the lavender dress, the blonde in the lavender dress, thinks that what the banks did 4 or 5 years ago by destroying the economy was great. Speak for yourself. I have to, and then, of course, Andrea Tantaros. And I have to give Elizabeth Warren some credit. Andrea. That temperature that you said she had? That's about the same as your IQ, so you're not in the you don't have any room to be giving any credit. Moran, Titanic twit.
she did in the Senate last week myself, personally. So, yes, I will embrace that. But I'll tell you what, when they shine a light on this lady, you don't rise to the top at Harvard by being some moderate wallflower. She's a radical leftist, and you're going to find out stuff about her that's not palatable for her to run. So I hope she runs. She probably has posters.
Wait. You don't go to Harvard unless you're a radical leftist? I seem to recall that they gave sheepskins to both Bishop Romney and Dear Leader over there at Harvard. I remember in the case of Dear Leader thinking that maybe it was time just to sort of do a whole Cartago Delenda est on the Harvard School of Business, and you know, leave no brick one upon the other, and salt the earth and all of that stuff. But you know, oh Jesus. So there we are at the end of the filibuster. We probably should crank up the. Phone lines. The numbers, of course, you probably know. 304-574-8178, unless you're new to the program. And if you are, hi! 304-574-8178, or the Gizmo line, 304-663-4676. 304-663-HORN, H-O-R-N, 304-663-HORN. They're both wide open and waiting for your conversation. Of course, if you want to work Skype to Skype, it's Bob Kincaid Horn. That's the contact account. If you've never done it before, just send me a contact request, and we'll get everything fired up right up, and you'll be involved in conversation radio. We try to raise $150 every evening. Thank you very kindly to Glenn for your subscription contribution that rolled in last night. Thank you indeed. And we've got a $75 challenge on the table, so if you want to kick in $75, Steve is willing to double your money, and we will get fundraising for this Titanic Tuesday taken care of. Note coming in from Ron and Raleigh, subject line, Eric Garner. All over the media, people keep referring to the story of Eric Garner selling loose cigarettes. Today, Bill Clinton repeated the shibboleth. While selling loose cigarettes is how police knew Eric Garner. At the time of his murder, he was breaking up a fight between some acquaintances. The selling loose cigarettes is how the libertarian idiots can hang their anti-tax arguments on the murder of a black man. By the way, did you hear Rush Limbaugh say that policemen had told him that it wasn't a chokehold that was used to kill Eric Garner? Oh, no, all you got to do is just go out and use that new device that's out there, Chris Rock having made mention of this. Use that new device that's out there for identifying racists. It's called Facebook. And you'll find it wasn't a chokehold all over the place. Nope, not a chokehold at all. Yeah, see, it's kind of easy, isn't it, Sergi? Taking their temperature. Sergi says, I know what their temperature is. They're 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Oh, okay. Thank you, Carol. It wasn't a chokehold, Bob. They call it a Staten Island love tap. Oh, for God's sakes. So, there we go. Let's see. We've got a line waiting on 574-8178. The Gizmo line is still open, 304-663-4676, 304-663-HORN. And we'll take a break. It being Tuesday, we have the Green News Report coming up from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. I'm looking forward to that. This is Conversation Radio, listener-supported. That's the only way we keep this all going. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
I'm leaving my home in Europe behind, heading out for a new state of mind. New York town is calling to me, dollaring off in the company, wanting to meet Leo Harding. Alone in the White House, watching the sun come up on the morning of 1921. I just want someone to talk to, to talk to, to talk to. I got no shoes upon my feet. I've been all day with nothing to eat. Sure gets hard down here in the street, but I know where I'm gonna be. One Camellia Harding, playing cards in the smoke the room, winning and losing, filling the time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just want someone to talk to, to talk to, to talk to.
mind. The cops and those in a rifle and spike. Remove the bullets just before daylight. They won't find now it'll be your eye. One, maybe a heartache. And lost her running out of days. And even the latest God moves in a strange way. I just want someone to talk to. Talk to, talk to. Don't leave me here on such a lonely day. Don't leave me here on such a lonely day.
It's Tuesday, December 16, 2014.
The A's are 56. The nays are 40. The motion to concur is passed.
Congress wraps up for the year Republican anti-environment initiatives to be signed by the president.
Every nation has a responsibility to do its part.
UN Climate Summit wraps up in Peru. All nations are in for the final treaty in Paris. Plus,
what I think on the left I get a little tired of is this idea that the sanctimonious idea that somehow science has decided all this and so therefore you can't have a view.
Another Bush, another climate change denier.
All of that and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It is not unanimous amongst scientists that disproportionately man-made.
Disproportionately man-made? What does that even mean, Jeb Bush? By the way, welcome to 2016, Governor. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, before we get to Jeb Bush and much more, we had a tornado in Los Angeles this week.
And it was a really weird and rare one, indeed.
In December. A tornado, rare enough, in December, even more so. Why didn't anybody warn me that we were going to get this insane, crazy weather on this planet?
Yeah, it's almost like scientists didn't warn you as they have been doing day in and day out and being totally ignored.
Yeah, but I can't hear them if I put my fingers in my ear and go, blah, 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 blah. Like Jeb Bush.
This is true.
But what do you have for us today?
Well, first, the United Nations Climate Treaty Conference ran into overtime over the weekend.
If we fail, future generations will judge our effort not just as a policy failure, but as a massive collective moral failure of historic consequence.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, that was U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry urging delegates at the United Nations climate treaty talks in Lima, Peru, to move aggressively on an emissions reductions treaty to be finalized in Paris 1 year from now. As happens every year, this year's talks in Lima went into overtime, but the delegates did reach an agreement on the building blocks, formally known as the Lima Call for Climate Action. The good news is, for the first time in history, all nations have committed to reducing their rate of emissions, including emerging economies of India, China, and Brazil.
You know, we cover these climate conferences every year. It seems they always end up in some form of a failure. Is it fair to say that this year we actually had a success, a breakthrough of sorts?
Yeah, that would be fair to say. However, critics did pan the accord as weak because it pushes off the most difficult questions until next year, questions of how much each country is going to cut, over how long a period, how they'll be measured, will it be legally binding, whether there will be financing for poor nations. It's a huge treaty with lots of moving parts. Another important breakthrough at the UN Climate Summit, a fund to help poor nations adapt to the impacts of global warming. It's called the Green Climate Fund. It met its initial funding threshold after President Obama pledged $3 billion, convincing other nations to contribute. However, the U.S. contribution to the Green Climate Fund has now been blocked by Republicans in Congress.
Of course.
That's part of the so-called Cromnibus government bill that was passed in the wee hours over the weekend, among a whole passel of anti-environment amendments that we reported on, including cuts to the EPA and changes in endangered species protections. Republicans also resurrected their zombie attack on light bulb energy efficiency standards.
Well, they did, but remember, The president and Republicans negotiated this agreement. This is something that Obama has agreed to.
And in other legislation, also a must-pass, the Defense Authorization Bill, Republicans inserted a land swap into that legislation, giving away sacred Apache lands to a foreign mining company.
Well, that's just patriotic of them, Desi.
Speaking of Republicans, Jeb Bush,
who?
The son of George H.W. and brother of George W.,
not ringing a bell,
as announced he is forming an exploratory committee to, quote, explore the possibility of running for president in 2016. What's his position on the climate? Well, back in 2011 on Fox News, he stopped just short of outright denial.
It is not unanimous among scientists that it is disproportionately man-made. What I think on the left I get a little tired of is this idea that the sanctimonious idea that somehow science has decided all this and so therefore you can't have a view. It's easy to fall into this trap that's created by the left. And I think Governor Perry, as it relates to global warming, has every right to suggest that it's not a certainty.
I love how even Jeb Bush, the supposedly reasonable one, is referring to science as if it is something from the left. I mean, where does he even get that?
A good question. As usual, ideology trumps science.
If science is on the left, I guess anti-science is what he represents on the right. We'll go with that, Governor. For much more on those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help the Green News Report stay on your public airwaves. For Bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Don't you run at me with science? She blinded me with science. Yeah.
They always do a great job, Brad and Desi do. 12 minutes past the hour, 16th day of December, 2014. Interesting comment from Anatole in the chat room as we cruise along. It's easy to fall into this extinction trap, you moron. You know what makes it really easy to fall into the extinction trap? Line it with money. I mean, that's better than you line the extinction trap with money, and right wingers and pig lickens will run into it. It's better than just putting a sugar cube on the ground and watching the ants come to it, because the ants at least then take the sugar cube and carry it back to the to the nest. But no, the wing nuts just Hey, let's go to the Skype line and talk to Lance. Hey, Lance.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I'm great. How about you?
Happy holidays.
And to you as well.
Thanks so much. So, the Newton gun suit is something that I am appreciative of. It's, I believe now 10 families have filed a civil suit against the manufacturers.
Yes.
And do you know the argument they're making?
Isn't it something along the lines of they knew or should have known that they were putting an incredibly dangerous instrumentality into the stream of commerce?
It's called an AR-15, which is the same weapon as an M-16.
Yes, or similar. I mean, it's not fully automatic.
They show the genesis that both came from the same manufacturer. The manufacturer had the rifle contracted out to the military before it became the AR-15. And their contention is that even people... First of all, civilians are not trained. Civilians are not trained, and even if they're trained, most people who buy the weapon do not understand its destructive power. That's their argument.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure nothing will come of it, but...
That's where you have to take into account the realities of the American legal system in a civil suit. If you get a great big honking verdict, because Remington is the owner of the captive company that manufactures the Bushmaster in this case, and what'll happen is they'll go bankrupt, and they'll tell the plaintiffs to go pound sand.
That's the way the system is set up.
Yes.
The same thing
happens by example in the coal industry. That's why there aren't any mines around here that aren't any mountains being blown up directly by Alpha Natural Resources. It's all God Loves America Coal LLC Inc. PC.
Right.
Or Sweet Lammy Jesus Carbon PC LLC Inc. And these are all because it makes it harder to climb up the corporate food chain and get where the real money is.
I wish I could grasp it all, Bob, and somehow turn it around, but I don't have the skills. I mean, I hear about all the legal precedents that go back and back and back, and then they make this precedent for corporations. I just don't think these people are on any average, normal person's side at all.
No, they're on the money side, because money. Yeah. Capitalism.
Well, I'm glad you brought up money, because I have a lot of thoughts on money.
I thought you were going to say you had a lot of money. Never mind. Go ahead.
I do not have a lot of money.
It's a joke. That's a joke, Lance.
Well, I was a financial advisor, and I have a story about that. I found the name of the gentleman who started talk radio, the weird, really weird Christian guy that has the British accent, you know, and he does Advice Line. Did you want me to say that name?
Oh, go ahead, sure.
It's Roy Masters.
Okay.
And he had the first talk show in 1961. And Roy Masters, talk about a mountebank. He does Christianity without mentioning it's Christianity. In other words, he doesn't trot out the good news first thing. He's just going to help you psychologically, you know.
Yeah, and that's the genesis of sort of soft-pedaled Christianity that winds up with Joel Osteen and a jumbotron to make Yankee Stadium blush.
Exactly, and that's the Christianity I'm most familiar with these days. Because I don't go to church, but I do see it on TV. And Joel Osteen and his ilk are the people who are on the TV. So anyway, he had Talk Radio Network, and he put Hannity out there and Limbaugh out there, and it was bought by whoever, and he's still broadcasting. And every time I hear him, it just totally creeps me out. Did you know that birdsong and speech come from the same genes?
No, I did not.
That's my scientific news for today.
Well, I find that very interesting because, according to the anthropologists, some of the oldest actual human language that is to be found in a little corner of India.
Yes.
And it sounds like chirping birds.
Yep. It says here, birdsong and human speech turn out to be controlled by the same genes. So I won't bother to read the text or anything, but it's a finding, you know. That's what we call it, a finding.
Yes.
And we're singing, so that's what we do.
And, well, there's a reason that the Iliad begins, "Sing me, O Muse."
Oh yes, I don't know the Iliad, but I'll trust you on it. this is for you. Men who enjoy spicy foods have higher levels of testosterone.
Well, doesn't that just explain everything?
It explains everything. It says right here, men who enjoy spicy food have higher testosterone levels. Researchers from the University of Grenoble. So, I mean, I'm Tapatio, that's it. It's a, you know, chili hot sauce we have out here.
No, I know, yeah, I know the stuff.
Yeah. So I saw that and thought of you. I wrote a line. It says, I will put my First Amendment remedy up against your Second Amendment remedy any day of the week. That's my line.
Until the Second Amendment,
Ideas win in the end. You know, if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't be in the arts. And Abraham Lincoln said so, and did I save it? I may not have saved it. First and second, here it is. what constitutes the bulwark of our liberty and independence? It's not our frowning battlements, our bristling seacoast, the guns of our war steamers, or the strength of our gallant and disciplined army. These are not our reliance against a resumption of tyranny in our fair land. They could all be turned against our liberties. Our reliance is the love of liberty which God has planted in our bosom. Our defense is the preservation of the spirit which prizes liberty as the heritage of all men in all lands everywhere. Destroy this spirit and you have planted the seeds of despotism around your own doors. So my First Amendment rights will trump your Second Amendment rights. Maybe not today.
But perhaps in the long run.
In the long run, ideas win, and Lincoln had some good ones. And, you know, this guy's a Republican.
Yeah, but we can't, those labels don't work back. They don't work, they don't translate, I guess is what I'm saying.
I know, it's all turned around.
But Lincoln, you know, Lincoln said a lot of stuff that was arguably liberal. I mean, a member of the Illinois legislature, was it? He was into the public financing of public works, like roads and stuff.
Okay. So not.
But he also, you know, it's one of those fun thought experiments, and it's almost impossible to contemplate what would a Lincoln administration have been without the Civil War. It's kind of like, what would the Kennedy administration have been without the Bay of Pigs and without the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yes.
It's so different as to be, you know, almost impossible to contemplate. Mm-hmm. But, one of the problems that Lincoln ran up against is he had to finance a war. And that's how he wound up having to deal with Salmon P. Chase, who was just an awful human being.
Mm.
Vain, vicious, catty, if you read Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, Salmon P. Chase comes across as the Frank Burns of the Lincoln administration.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting over there, he's just boiling with jealousy and envy. He thinks that Lincoln is a bumpkin and a doofus and doesn't have enough brains to pour piss out of a boot with directions on the heel. And Lincoln is just constantly outthinking him, but what Salmon P. Chase had was the ability to hobnob and rub elbows with the financial boys who had bought him a long time before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, and the Civil War marks that critical turning point in the American experience where government figures out that it can run on debt instead of cash.
Ah. And Lincoln was part of this, right?
Absolutely.
So the Republicans don't want to own up to that?
No. No.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Well, I don't know the history as well as you do, and on debt, I've been debt-free since year 2000, so I'm my own personal conservative when it comes to finances. Keynesian economics seems to be more appropriate than the stuff we get from, who's that European that they follow so slavishly?
Ludwig von Mises.
Yeah, von Mises. That's their guy. I'm von Mises. You will make this clean.
Absolutely. You will return to the gold standard.
Yeah. So I don't go for any of that stuff. And
does it tell you that the von Mises Institute is at Auburn, Alabama, okay? It's not in New York. It's not in San Francisco or L.A. It's not even in Philly or Boston. It's in Auburn, freaking Alabama.
Okay. Can I share some thoughts on personal finance?
You certainly may.
Well, you know,
I might learn something.
Well, I have a teaching mission to generations younger than me. You know, millennials, Gen Xers, and there's a new one called Bloomlets or Gen Zs. When I graduated high school, I hated money. It was the thing to do. You wanted to be pure. You didn't want to sell out to the man. And I was like that until I was at least 30 years old. And it was turn on, tune in, drop out. And I definitely turned
on. Timothy Leary.
Pardon?
Timothy Leary.
I met him once. Anyway, you know, I definitely tuned in or turned on. I tuned in, and that was my whole goal in those years of my life, was to tune in to my talents and earn my living as a writer. That was what I wanted to do. You know, money was evil. If you took money, you were being co-opted, you know? That's how I thought about it for almost 20 years. And then 38, and this big Wall Street firm hires me as a financial advisor. I had the little baby. I had to make money. It was the first time in my life I ever took a job, you know, just to try and have a career where I could make money. So they hired me. They called me a financial advisor. Not only did I have nothing, I did not know anything about finance, because they hired me because I was a salesman. That's why they hired me. So I had to think about finance, about money, in a very serious way. And I'm going to skip the Russian finance. So because I had to deal with it. I had to look at it. So, you know, if our liberal side of the spectrum is being outmoneyed by the other side, maybe we should get more money. So what I have is
a lovely idea.
Well, I had to change myself to do it. And I do research. I'm research oriented. So there's six ways to get money, and five of them don't work. And I'm going to take one little sip and run these down, and you can find money, you can win money, you can steal money, you can print money. You can also receive money as a gift, which is normally an inheritance. So none of those, for a guy like me who needs a regular income, none of those work. Finding money, I get a dime. Winning money, you know, I don't have the fortitude to be a professional gambler. Stealing money is not
illegal.
It's illegal. You know, there's consequences. The risk is, I measure it as higher than the reward, but other people don't. So, and then printing money is probably even a worse crime than stealing money. And receiving money as a gift, like an inheritance or a birthday gift. You know, my inheritance is a $50 bill and a lottery ticket. So,
right.
Most of us, that's 1% stuff, you know. Okay, the last one is in two parts, and it's the only way you get money. You accept or take money in exchange for goods and or services. And it was so hard for me, because I didn't want to take money from people. I really didn't, you know?
That's, well, yeah, it feels kind of gross, and yeah.
It feels icky. But I had to face up to the reality that I can't print it. I can't survive by finding it or winning it.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, just looking at the origins of this country, what you're perhaps inadvertently tapping into is one of the fundamental debates about what this country was going to be. You know, Jefferson envisioned this world of decently educated yeoman farmers fanning out across the continent and building this idealistic republic, where every man would, you know, sit beneath his apple tree and grow figs or something like that. I don't know.
Was that a barter economy?
Largely, it would be.
Yes, it would. And we have barter economies. You know, villages in Alaska, the ones I see on, you know, Netflix anyway, they combine. They hunt. They have salmon. They have bear. But they need gasoline, and that takes cash.
Right, and you can even to go back before the hydrocarbon economy, because I spend a lot of time thinking about my forebears, my ancestors, because I feel like there's an answer hiding back there that I just haven't found. But for instance, my great grandfather, his name was Ozias Goad. How's this for a name, Lance? Get this, Ozias Azarin Goad.
I love that middle Azarin.
Yeah,
that's great.
He moved here in about 1892 and got his hands on some acreage and set up farming. And I've been studying the family history going on, and that's all they were smallholder farmers. In 1661, one of my ancestors went to the parish church in North Farnham in what was then Old Rappahannock County, Virginia. And he tithed 1 pound of tobacco to the church.
Mm. Kill them all off.
and well, I figure that covers, you know, that pretty much covers everybody down to, you know, down to my family. The church has gotten enough. But anyway, so they were smallholder farmers. Hell, maybe they were, for all I know, they were sharecroppers or maybe even indentured servants. But they got loose and they got moving. He gets here in the early 1890s, sets up farming, and he raised everything he needed. About the only thing that he could not make on the place was gunpowder, shotgun shells, bullets. They did not weave their own cloth, and they would occasionally buy some sugar. And so he would trade his excess produce from his farm in exchange for the things that he could not purchase, or that he could not produce, rather.
Like in Alaska, they'll trade salmon because they're sick of eating it for some bear meat. That's what they do. So this part six, that you have to do these exchanges with other people because you can't make the money.
Yeah.
You don't do those other things. You get this in two different ways. And the first A is what we're most familiar with, is by your personal labor. And I did my personal labor for 46 years. Longer, really, but I became a professional at age 19. So I'm very familiar with laboring for my wages. And then the other way, however, is you can do it through a portfolio of holdings, like the land that your great-grandfather acquired, or rent on a studio apartment. You own the apartment, you provide shelter, and someone gives you money for the shelter. That's what they do. So the other, you know, that whole turn on, tune in, drop out, I didn't do the dropout part. I never left, you know, suburban, urban culture. So I have no self-sustaining resources to speak of. But I do have a portfolio because I spent 26 years making it, making that portfolio. And that's what I live off right now. I don't even have Social Security right now. I'm just living off the portfolio, and I try to keep it, you know, to the dividends and interest it throws off. So there's two kinds of freedom. There's spiritual freedom, which is freedom of the mind. And, you know, I've had that for a long time. I mean, they lock me up, turn the key. If they give me a crayon, I can still write. And that's freedom of the mind. The other is financial freedom, which is freedom of the body, or freedom of action. And, you know, with a little nest egg like mine, you can have some. I don't get, you know, I'm home all day, but my job is to stay at home and not go out and spend money. That's my job. But I do get two vacations a year, although we often don't take the spring vacation. And, you know, if I want to go get a coffee and a blueberry muffin in the morning, I can. And I do. And, you know, that's freedom of the body. And that's, it has to be done somehow.
And, well, let me ask you this, Lance. In putting your portfolio together, do your ethics and your morals come into that as well?
It depends. I began without ethics. In other words, I wanted to learn how I could do what they were telling me to do. Remember, I'm working for a Wall Street firm. Everybody knows.
Yeah.
And I'm working at the retail level, which means the branch level. Let me say, did you see Wolf of Wall Street?
I have not yet. I'm familiar with it somewhat.
Everything in that movie happened to me, except on a much smaller level, because I was retail, and that was the owner of a firm, you know, back in New York. So if you want to see the real Wall Street as I lived it, it's in that movie. And I was interested in surviving. I was interested in, you know, I had to buy a house. I was living in a crappy little, I have poetry about how I've been in apartments for so long, will I ever escape, you know? So I had to have, I'd never had financial success. That's what I was thinking of. So I learned, how do you do it? And I do it in a very conservative, long-term way. There's two ways to do it. You can speculate, which means short-term guesses, or you can just go long, way long. And that's what I did. And the what I learned is there's only five asset classes in the whole universe. There's only five. So you go in and you say, well, what are your, you know, you hold companies. Are you holding any tobacco companies? That's moral. That's morality. And I haven't focused on that. I, you know, typically hold mutual funds and this new kind of thing they have called ETFs, which are basically kind of like mutual funds. And so I don't, these mutual funds hold anywhere from 50 to 300 companies per fund. And rather than study the companies that the funds hold, I study the performance of the funds. And I work with my former partner, who's on this because it's his job, to know who's managing the fund. In other words, if you got a good manager, he could leave for another firm, and now that you don't have a good manager anymore. So you have to, when you're investing like this, you have to think about who is managing my money. Who
it's like watching it's like watching a baseball team's pitching staff.
That's what I follow, is who is managing my money. And I've got a lot of different, I've got, for me personally, about 12 different pieces can make a portfolio. And so that means I've got about a dozen different pieces that I have to follow. Not every day. I do it quarterly or semi-annually or whatever. And I definitely do my projections once a year. That's rule number one, is you run a financial projection, assets minus liabilities, going forward to your day you die. In my case, it's age 90. And it is that projection which tells you how to allocate those five asset categories. Because we're just talking about assets. I mean, we can talk liabilities, too. If you need to borrow some money, I could, in the old days, I could sell you an equity access account on your property there. But I'm the one, I enjoy the asset side, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's something about what I learned in that business for 26 years. And
you've got a question coming in, Lance.
Oh, wonderful.
Bill and Helena wants to know, he says, do you have any thoughts on the dropping price of oil and its potential to affect the economy as a whole? He says, well, I have read some opinion pieces that it might cause loan defaults for the drilling outfits and subsequent ripple effects through the economy, kind of like what happened when the housing bubble went up in smoke.
Yeah. You know, I'm not an economist, and I don't make moves based on stuff like that. I buy stuff. What I do is I buy highest quality possible stuff I can buy, generally with a track record, and I have a time horizon of, you know, 10 to 15 years. That's my time when I buy something. And so I check periodically to see if anything's fallen apart, and if it has, I switch it out for something else. So that's how I do it. I don't time the market. I made one big good market call when I was still working in the industry, which is I called the top of the market in 2008, and that saved me quite a bit. But what I would say about the oil is, look at what I cannot speak. I'm no longer licensed, so I cannot say anything specific, particularly about what investment to buy or what, you know, personal strategy would be. The thing that strikes me on the oil is it has dropped 40%. Is not correct?
Yeah, it's. And I've heard a lot of explanations. I've heard that the Saudis are trying to, in one fell, and it makes sense, in one fell swoop, the Saudis are trying to wipe out the American and Canadian tar sands, goop, Bakken crude goop market, and at the same time, just knock the bejesus out of the Russian market.
And if
that's the case, it appears to be working. Because
yeah.
I don't know if you saw what happened to the ruble.
It's on my desktop. I have it right here. Russian finance.
Yeah, the ruble went in the toilet yesterday.
I know. And so they're trying to jack up the rates. Here's the, from me, all the stuff you talk, it's fun, it's interesting, and believe me, it's how we lure customers. But for a guy like me, it's static. What counts for me is that before you know it, the market dropped 40%. That is a bear market, and any market can do that overnight. When I was hired, I think it was 86, I have no stocks, I have no clients, nothing happened to me, but I watched the market, stock market drop from 1,400 down to 700 in like 3 days. So that's what I care about. I care about whatever oil and gas holdings I may have in my these portfolios that I own, they're hit. Is it time to buy or time to sell?
And that's that. I mean, that's picking that in many ways. That's picking the red square or the black square at the roulette wheel, isn't it?
Not if you have a 15-year time horizon. It's time to buy the highest quality you possibly can. But you do that as part of a whole portfolio. You know, there's the equity markets are. Here's the next thing I wanted to get to. The equity markets are proxy for the economy. In fact, it's a leading indicator. And that's what it is. And economies, the fundamental thing about a market, it will keep growing so long as the population is growing. If you stop the population, as these right-wing, pig-sniffing Republicrats want to do, which is to stop hardworking people from coming into our country to help us and buy our securities and be a success, and the Republicans want to stop all that, they're idiots. They're idiots. Because I used to have a program that showed the UN figures about population growth worldwide. It's definitely going up through 2050. Up, 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 up. Is it going to be middle-aged white men? No. No. So,
well, listen. Okay. You know. So let me kind of circle us back to an essential question, because I find the topic academically interesting. It can't.
Oh, good.
Wait. But it can't be real world interesting for me, because I can't buy a single share of Amalgamated Nothing.
Yeah. Well,
okay, and just wait, because you know, the financial questions that a lot of people in the Horn Family Commune congregation are asking are not questions of, I mean, you know, something like the ethics of owning hydrocarbon stocks, be it coal, oil, gas, whatever. That's beyond our ken. Okay.
Yeah.
Our economic questions are, how do I eat tomorrow?
I understand.
And
I lived that way for 38 years.
And so, you know, I think the question is, when the folks who have the real, honest to goodness Jed Clampett walking around money go bull in the China shop on us, you know, bull markets and bear markets, what does that mean for us? You know, we saw this bill, the so-called Cromnibus, go through the Senate and the House. We saw Elizabeth Warren stand up and bravely point out the fact that we were doing another giveaway for the Wall Street banks. We're begging them to bring us another crash, even as the market itself is going through the damn roof. While we have crumbling bridges, falling apart infrastructure, and a member of the Senate can't bring himself to sign off on a $22 million pissant package to help returning veterans not commit suicide, Lance.
I understand.
So what does it mean for those of us who are out here struggling in the trenches to say that the market is bull or bear? I guess that's my question.
I don't know if it's bull or bear. I'm saying that I consider the decline of the stock market. The stock market isn't a decline. You're talking about the oil market.
Yeah.
I consider it a buying opportunity because it's a 40% decline, which is a classic bear market. Now, commodities, I don't know commodities. I know stocks and a little bit of bonds, and stocks the most. And so commodity markets may be different, but that's just how I view it. But I don't make an investment for will it make money 6 months or year, 18 months from now. I don't do that.
So let me ask you. You talked about how you got out and everything. did you just get sick of it, or just came to quitting time, or, I mean,
because... You pay for everything. Nothing is free. The crash of 2000, year 2000, which was the dot-com crash,
yeah,
gave me a stroke. You pay for everything. And they let me sit there. For 2 years, I could not sit at my desk. And then they let me come back and sit there at the desk and kind of pretend I was working. And I spent 8 years, like 2 years kind of off, and then 8 years going to the office in a back corner cubbyhole and sitting there because I couldn't look at a computer screen, much less turn to the telephone and call people. So, and that's where I tried to file for disability and just got blown out of the water. So that's what I did, and retired at 65, and, you know, that those 8 years kept adding to the, it's the 401k, kept adding to the 401k, and that's what I did. But all this stuff takes a toll on you. I did not wind up working with my hands. My dad was great at that, and my son is great at that. I'm crappy. I have a horrible tremor. You know, I tried to tune up my VW Bug when I was 16, and the car wouldn't start after I did it, you know. So, you know, also, when I was in the early 70s, I read an article that said the future economy is going to be a service economy, not a manufacturing economy. So I kind of geared myself to being in the service economy way back in the early 1970s. So what was your question? It was, you know, what happened? I got a stroke from running people. It's very, you know.
Okay, so...
there is responsibility involved, you know,
yeah.
When you're trying to help people protect their first concern is protecting their net worth, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what they want to protect, that pool, because that's what they got. And that's your first responsibility, and that doesn't work. Guess what happens? It's pretty stressful.
Well, I'll be honest, Lance. I don't have any trust whatsoever. I trust a blackjack dealer in Vegas more than I trust some investment banker at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I dealt in, trust, because I've worked ever since sixth grade to make teachers trust me. And like I say, it's part of my Montebank tradition, you know.
Yeah.
It's con man. You know con man? It means confidence man.
Sure. Exactly.
You win the confidence. And, you know, I know how to do that. I'm in a book. You can pick it up. It's called The Fool and His Money by Rothschild. It's a Penguin book. I'm in there.
Wow.
So, yeah.
In a bad way or a good way?
Oh, he said I was going to be the most successful because I didn't know the first thing about finance, but I knew how to do commedia dell'arte. I had a theater background. I know how.
Yes, okay. So, see, there's the value of the liberal arts. Exactly.
Okay.
Hey Lance, I've got. It seems to me that pretty likely that we're gonna hear from a lot of other people on a lot of topics, probably touching on this. I thank you very much, and
thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Have a good evening.
Bye bye.
Bye now. And that's Lance calling from I do believe Southern California. Let's go to the Gizmo line, where Jim is. Hey Jim.
What's up, Bob?
What's happening?
Oh, another day in Louisiana, Stan.
No oyster po' boy this evening?
Nah, I'm just going to settle for a frozen pizza.
Well, you know, it can't be oyster po' boys every day.
Yeah, throw in a little Gouda. It's low budget night, whatever. But I met Timothy Leary once, actually back in 76, November. Was it November 16th? 76. 2 weeks after Carter won the election, he was speaking at UNL. So, and he was talking about SMILE, space migration and intelligence and life extension. I guess that went the way of old Timothy Leary. But I was going to ask you about, you mentioned when you were talking earlier, you were talking about Bush 3, he's testing the waters to run. Do you think he has a chance?
What do you mean has a chance? If it's he has to that family is so weird and so pathological, Jim. He's probably, you know, because Dim Leader ran against Al Gore, you know, to get vengeance for Clinton beating Pappy. So who knows what kind of weird psychology is at work there? Does he have a chance? Of course he has a chance. He's always got a chance. You know, they can tap into the money. And he's
I interrupted him. Let me just.
No, go ahead.
Even after what Bush 2 did, I mean, I know Americans have no memory, especially the idiots who consistently vote against their own economic self-interest. And I believe I got them, you know, I just can't, I mean, what's the previous call was just saying? In 07, the crash of 07, 08, that was totally brought on by, and it's not just Bush 2 by himself, but it's the Republican mindset, and they're already getting ready to go back to that, as you were just talking.
What's the old saying? A dog always returns to his vomit?
Yeah, I guess.
Well, they're ready to go back. They've developed a taste for bile, I guess.
Yeah, and that's just, I just find that frustrating. It's like my sister a couple weeks ago at some family thing at dinner, and she was like, wow, who are we going to get for president in 2016? And I could tell it was like the Republican, it was like a Republican tinge to it, which, you know, okay, you know, you're the one with the kid, you messed up this planet a lot, you know, it's not only economically, but ecologically, even more than you can imagine. Maybe I'm just, do you not agree? I mean, it's not just the economy, it's the ecology that we're screwing up.
It's everything, right? Jim, it's everything, but I'm in kind of a sorry, bad place, realizing that half of my fellow countrymen go, well, sometimes you just got to cram something up a Muslim's butt to make yourself feel better.
Exactly. Exactly. That sounds like a lot of my family members. They just see the short term. They just don't. They don't see any long term. You know, I mean, it's you can talk to you blue in the face, and they just don't understand. It's, you know, basically the same at work. I mean, some people kind of get it. And I'm not pontificating at my little job, but that much, that's not the gig I was hired for. But you know, when I talk to people, if that comes up, I'll let them know where I stand. But it's just weird. Bush 3. I mean, just the irony of it, but in 2000, when I voted in the presidential beauty pageant, I went ahead and voted for Nader as kind of a protest vote, figuring that there was no way the country would reelect another Bush after Bush 1. And plus, hey, maybe I'm obviously more enlightened than most people, realizing that knowing that Bush 1 was in the CIA, was the head of the CIA, and not only that, what his father did. I was aware of that back then, thinking that most people wouldn't vote for him, or not most, a majority, majority did not vote for him, but somehow Gore would have been able to win, although he was, but it wouldn't have been that close. But even Bush 3 ran, well, I just call him Bush 3, it'll still be a close race, no matter who the president
is. I think every presidential contest from here on out is probably going to be 52-48, 51-49, 50.5, 49.5, because that's the way that that is the degree to which this country is divided, and that is how you set up the margin where, if you really need to dummy up one, that's how you get. Because, see, the Republicans had to have the presidency in 2000. You know why, Jim? Because there was a...
Set up to court.
No, 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 no. Don't get all highfalutin and philosophical on me.
Sorry.
The Republicans had to have the presidency in 2000 because there was a great goddamn big pile of money laying around. And it was just laying there without them to be a-loving on it. It was just laying there, and Al Gore was talking about putting it in a lockbox or something, or shoring up Social Security or something like that. That ain't no fun when all that money's just laying there and the Republicans could go off to you know, see Republicans. Yeah, the rest of us go to Vegas or Atlantic City or you know, down over to one of the casinos. Yeah, Republicans go to Wall Street to gamble.
Yeah.
Okay. And so all that money was laying there, and they wanted it. And they knew, Jim, they were going to wreck the economy. I mean, I remember reading about all the tax break bullshit when George was hustling it the first time through. And everybody there said, listen, the chickens are going to come home to roost about a year after he's out of office. And the only thing wrong with that prediction was that it turned out that the chickens came home about a year early, and that's why we got the collapse when we got the collapse. But everybody knew it was coming. And that's, you know, that's why they wanted the presidency. So that's what makes, see, I maintain that in 2008, they didn't want the presidency. That's why we got McCain as the nominee. And in 2012, they were kind of iffy on the presidency because that's how you get Willard Romney, all right? They'll only get serious about really, really wanting the presidency. And make no mistake, John McCain wanted to be president, and Willard Romney wanted to be president. But by and large, it was okay if they didn't, because, look, when Democrats get into the Oval Office, almost without fail, they create jobs, and they pile up money inside the government. And they try to be fiscally responsible. And then only after there's been a great gob of money laid by does somebody come along and start talking about, hey, well, it's your money. We're going to give you back your money. And the next thing you know, they've stolen you blind. So it will depend on what kind of financial footing the government is on in 2016 as to how serious the Republicans get about pursuing the presidency. I'm guessing, you know, based on the fact that the deficit has fallen at rates that are just astonishing, I'm thinking we're probably getting some money put aside, and by 2016 they may be interested in having it, which is why you'll get a Bush. Okay, the Bushes, even though they're a bunch of sort of nouveau riche, classless asshats. I mean, you know, they don't have the old money panache. What is it? Kitty Kelly's book on the Bushes or the Reagans or the who the hell ever. She talks about how Barbara Bush was incensed back when she gave a cowboy boot umbrella holder to the Reagans as a Christmas gift, and Nancy didn't think much of it. But they're tacky. They aspire to be treated with the sort of romance that the country treats the Kennedy family. And so they're still, you know, they've still got an axe to grind, and they still got a chip on their shoulder. So if Jebby wants it, if Jebby enters the race, it will mean that the Republicans really do want the presidency. Because they won't fool around with a Mormon bishop, or you know, a half crazed bad bomber pilot, or you know, some guy who brings dead fetuses home to play with, or amateur paleontologist Newton Leroy Gingrich. If they're serious about it, it'll be Jebby. If they're not, it'll be one of the weirdos.
Then it almost starts to seem like monarchy, because then if it's Bush versus Clinton, I mean, except for rare exceptions.
No. It's
those two families.
That's not monarchy. It's empire, Jim. It's empire.
Yeah.
So you've got Caesar. He adopts Augusta. He adopts Octavian. Octavian's just a grand nephew of his. But he adopts him as his son. He takes the name Caesar. He doesn't have a son, and instead it winds up being Tiberius, who's the son of Livia, who is actually from the Nero family. And a little tight, little toxic circle of families begins intermarrying and interweaving themselves until they get to the point that they've just killed everybody off, and that happens when Nero stomps his pregnant wife to death.
Wow. It's weird how history repeats.
And then you get a succession of pissant emperors, and then along come the Flavians. And the Flavians provide some, but I'm not going to go there. But what I'm saying is, this is typical empire behavior. It's oligarchy as well.
Yeah.
You know, this is not the Plantagenets and the Lancasters and the Yorks. This is the, eventually, I don't know, 100 years from now, Flapjack Bush Obama Clinton III may be president of the United States. Because then all the families will have interwoven, and boom, emperor. See how it works?
Well, yeah, it's kind of scary. Hey.
The next generation of Bushes has already won political office. Little George, who Babs referred to as the little brown one, and was busted for doing donuts in somebody's yard on a four-wheeler or some such down in Florida, is now the Texas Land Commissioner. Okay? He's on the ladder. He's on what the Romans called the cursus honorum. Chelsea's got her a pretty little baby. Bill and Hillary are grandparents. We're off and running.
Yeah.
And you know, Carol points out, you know, we could make a movie. The Inbred Empire Strikes Back.
I know. Well, I mean,
all of this that we're talking about, Jim, is something that the framers really didn't want to happen. They didn't particularly care for the idea of a hierarchy determined by genetics. It was supposed to be a meritocracy of sorts. And that's how in 1860 you can get an Abraham Lincoln. Or how you
that's
can wind up with an Andrew Jackson, because they rise to the yearnings of the public will. But then after the Civil War, you get this odious string of corporate lickspittles that continues up to Teddy Roosevelt. Taft is a reaction to Roosevelt. Roosevelt feels betrayed by Taft because Roosevelt deliberately got out of the way to let Taft run. Then Taft turns out to be just another Republican joker, which gives you Wilson, which gives you Harding. And wow, didn't we start the program with Harding and then Coolidge and the rape of the American, well, I don't like that word, the plundering of the American economy through the 1920s, and hello, Depression.
Hoover, yeah. Hoover's 28, right?
Yep, three meals a day, oatmeal, miss a meal, and skip a meal.
Yeah. Well, one more thing, we were talking about I missed the beginning of it, but that school where they have the little quiet time thing. I mean, you were talking about the Buddhist aspect of it. I used to be a Buddhist. Well, if I was in that class, could I chant the Lotus Sutra? Would I be allowed to? Because it would take about 20, 25 minutes. Morning.
Well, Well, no, you only get a minute, but if you have to chant in order to satisfy your religion, part 2.1 says that no teacher can prevent you from praying if you decide to pray. So it's designed to be a moment of silence in which the Christians can then begin all praying out loud and help bring others to Christ Jesus.
Well, see, I can envision myself being there and just breaking out and I'm going to get killed. Yeah, that might cause a little disruption down in Alabama, yeah. Back in the day.
Yeah.
So, one more thing, I was just going to let you go. What was it? When a Buddhist chants in a classroom and no one's there, does he make a sound?
I think that's a question for the ages.
That's kind of a little Zen cone stealing I did there. All right, Bob. Well, man, once again, you enlightened me. Didn't give me the answer I really was hoping for, the reality.
Well, what did you want?
Everything's coming up roses and.
We're all gonna drink that free bubble up and eat that rainbow pie, and it's gonna be frisbees and wheat Chex for everybody.
That and oyster po' boys are on the house.
Oh,
heaven forever. So yeah. Tonight I got pizza. I got a frozen pizza. So all right. Well, thanks a lot, Bob.
All right, Jim. You have yourself a good evening. Bye now. Our buddy Jim calling from Louisiana, Stan. I spent the rest of the evening last night thinking about that oyster po' boy. Woo! Yeah. Love the way you think, Lottie. If that was me, Bob, and I was a student there, I'd bring a Quran and a prayer rug for that moment of silence and see how fast it ended. And it would. Oh, no, that ain't the kind of prayer that we meant. I mean, they just sit at their desks, right? Nope, got to get the rug out. He doesn't have to say anything, but he does have to, you know, bend over and put his head on the floor. But that's Muslim stuff, like our president does. Yeah. 7 minutes past the hour. We'll take a little break and recharge the phone lines if you wish. Oh, no, let's don't take a break. I think we're about to experience a moment of, could it be, dare I hope, marvelous coherence. Good evening, Diane.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Oh, I appreciated your synopsis of the political cycle. I thought it was right on target. And
well, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to give you a little bit about what's on the ground in Kansas, Stan.
Do please.
Okay. I was just looking at the college newspaper, and there was a die-in in November to protest Michael Brown's death, murder. And so there was a picture in the newspaper online of a lot of students dressed in black, but on the floor, laid out on the floor. And then a few days later, in the same union, there was a kind of, I don't know if you'd call it theater arts, but there were three rooms, and they were called Tunnels of Oppression. And it was about micro-oppression. So one room, that how oppression gets enacted on an individual level in a passive way, and in another room, how those interpersonal relations involving oppression gets acted out in an active way. Anyway, and so there was that in November on campus, and I continue to think that if it's happening here in the heartland, there's something going on, which, of course, obviously there is something going on nationally. What followed is that the administration in the College of Business, we had a meeting, and about a quarter of the meeting was taken up with the first item on the agenda, which was that three administrators got up and said, we need to support the students and we need to speak out, all who are interested, against the foul racist language that has cropped up on that Yik Yak social media site. I don't know if you remember, I told you.
Yes, yes.
Told you about that. And so that was the reaction from the College of Business. There was a mobilization of a letter actually written by a friend of mine in the college, a faculty member, and then signatures were gathered. But, you know, a full quarter of that meeting was taken up with examining what our response should be as responsible community members. So there you go. It's some light in the tunnel, I guess.
No, that's actually pretty pretty astonishing. Or maybe it's my confirmation bias sneaking out, but I'm pleased to note it.
Because you might have thought that people in the College of Business wouldn't behave that way. I don't know. There is that perception. Although I will tell you that it is not by design, but there is a critical mass of faculty. It's very unusual, critical mass of faculty in the College of Business working on some aspect of ethics, corporate social responsibility. It's in the accountants, and that's kind of unusual because nationally, they can't seem to get there. But anyway, so maybe that letter is a manifestation of what's, you know, in our faculty. And it's not by design. It's not by design that we hired people with an interest in ethics, as far as I can tell. It's just kind of happened, and it's unusual. And so there you go. That's one report. And then, if I may, the next report is a very brief one about the performance of my students. One group gave a report on the Upper Big Branch mining disaster.
Yes, I've been kind of curious to hear this.
Yeah, and the last group gave a report on Freedom Industries, and these are cases that I signed this semester because of the education I have obtained from listening to you and what's on your program and what you've talked about on MSNBC and so on. So these are new cases I assign, and they were both rendered in 2 hours. Each group had 2 hours, a little more than 2 hours, actually. Very thoughtfully, very fact, you know, grounded in the facts. And both came, as is the case, came to the conclusion that there needed to be more effective regulation. This is what I always find once ideology is taken out of the way, and certainly nothing gets framed as political in my classes. All that out of the way, they come to that conclusion. And not only at Kansas State, but elsewhere where I teach. And I teach the gamut from undergrads, MBAs, to executive PhDs, actually. So all of them go there, which I think may be surprising to some people. I had a gentleman as a visiting professor in a university outside of Chicago, and there's a really cool program there for executives getting a PhD in value-based leadership. So the last time I was up there, which was in May, one gentleman in the class, it's a small auditorium, announced, well, he's a card-carrying capitalist. And I'm like, you know, I'm there to teach about corporate social responsibility leadership. And he's there because he's interested in it. So there you go. It's kind of strange that he would make that announcement. But I'm like, okay, that's, you know, that's fine. Here we go. And, you know, he came out looking at cases and saying, well, there needs to be more government regulation here than there. I mean, he and I actually met, and that, you just didn't get that kind of statement out of the way. And people that I'm in contact with come out on the side of community and taking care of one another almost all the time, if not all the time. So anyway, back to Kansas State, the undergrads that gave the presentation on Freedom Industries, they ended by showing a cartoon on their PowerPoint slides. Have you seen the cartoon in the Houston Chronicle about Freedom Industries? Just a one-frame cartoon?
It's one of those if you hum a few bars kind of things. I may have or may not. It's hard to tell.
Okay. Oh, say, can you say no? Okay, so there in the picture, there's this river, this water, and there are skulls and crossbones all over the water. And then on the land right by this water, in fact, the source of all these skull and crossbones are these three big storage tanks, and you see that Freedom Industries is written on the first one in view. And so away from the storage tanks are these two characters that are looking down into the water where all these skull and crossbones are pouring out of the containers. And one is a fellow with a shirt. It just says West Virginia. I guess so that fellow must be emblematic, maybe is supposed to be emblematic of the residents. And another guy is in a business suit and tie, and he's elbowing the West Virginia, and it says, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And coming out of his mouth in the big bubble comment is this. It's a good thing we don't have stronger government regulations getting in the way of our, quote, freedoms, unquote. That's what my students closed with.
And that's it in a nutshell. You might, by the way, note coming in from Carol when you were talking about teaching out there. She said, Diane, you also teach some of the stumps out here listening, like me.
Oh, no, 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 no. Oh, thank you, Carol. Carol is always so generous to me. But I have to go on record as saying that is so nice and generous, but I don't perceive I'm doing that when I call in. I don't presume I have anything to teach anyone on this program.
Oh, but you do. Maybe. You absolutely do. After the program closes, Diane, I will send this along. You might, I don't know. Are you going to see these students again after break?
These undergraduates, they took their final, what's today, Tuesday? Oh, yeah, they took their final yesterday, so I'll only be in contact by email with them if I choose to.
Insofar as they worked on the Freedom Disaster.
Uh-huh.
And that's the way I refer to it now. It's the Freedom Disaster.
Yeah. Yes. Isn't that have meaning?
Mm. Just a couple of days ago, the report to the Joint Committee on Government and Finance of the West Virginia Legislature by the Public Water System Supply Study Commission was released.
Yeah.
And it's 50 pages or so.
Mm.
But there are hair-raising things in there that are just, I don't know, they gave me the sense that we're not going to do really anything to prevent another one of these things from happening. And there is a self-serving argument about why they didn't shut the system down. And some of it is, I guess it makes some sense. Well, we couldn't shut the water system down because then what if we had a fire? We wouldn't be able to put the fire out. It would burn down.
God almighty. Give them enough time, and they'll just come up with
it. Well, give them enough time. They'll be telling us that the MCHM that 300,000 people ingested wasn't poison at all. It's actually good for you, you know, like
yes,
the astronauts,
yes.
Like Tang.
Yeah. Up is down, down is up.
But the thing is, there's a statement in there that essentially translates to, well, we didn't really know what we were doing because we didn't know if MCHM was toxic, and since we didn't know if it was toxic, we assumed it wasn't toxic, so...
Oh, this anti-science business. I mean, of course, that's just a rationale. That's just cover-up. Who knows what they really believe, and if they figured that out post-hoc, But that's it just fits in with an anti-science view.
Well, I mean, okay, so here's a line from it. The commission recommends that all occurrences of spills must be promptly relayed to any potentially impacted public water systems and to the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources. Additionally, all spills must be reported with reference to standardized GPS, blah, 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 blah. How about let's work on not having spills, Diane?
Yeah.
I mean, I know that sounds a little nuts, but...
No, because it's like getting caught up in the minutia of it and losing the whole point, huh?
Yeah. Let's see. This you'll love this. In his test, and this is citing testimony from the president of West Virginia American Water. In his testimony before a congressional committee, West Virginia American Water President Jeff McIntyre stated, "After considering the existing circumstances and potential options, we in the West Virginia Bureau for Public Health determined that the best course of action was to keep the water treatment plant running and institute the Do Not Use for several critical reasons. One, in addition to loss of water for drinking, cooking, and bathing, a shutdown would have quickly resulted in the loss of basic sanitation capabilities for approximately 300,000 people." Okay, so I get that. They're saying that, but wait, people lost their water for drinking, cooking, and bathing. Two, a shutdown would have also quickly resulted in a loss of fire protection in the nine counties.
They don't have backups?
Three, we had no way at that time to determine or estimate the duration of the chemical spill or resulting plume that would affect the water treatment plant. And four, shutting down the plant, losing the system, and then restarting it would have been a prolonged, difficult process, keeping the customers out of water for any use for a substantially longer period of time than the actual period that the Do Not Use order was in place. Restarting after system loss would have required us to use chlorinated water to disinfect pipes that had been depressurized and exposed to air, flush that chlorinated water, and refill and repressurize this highly complex system with approximately 1,900 miles of mains, more than 100 water storage tanks, and 179 pressure zones. It's almost as if they've completely forgotten that the water was already contaminated with methylchlorohexane methanol.
While you were reading that, I was thinking, blah, 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 sold to an American, you know, that old thing,
yeah,
that
exactly.
Old line. Oh, and I told my students they didn't have to pronounce that word, so they didn't. They just used the acronym.
MCHM. What makes me more than a little bit crazy out of this is the fact that, so they're talking about why they issued the Do Not Use order, which is what happened at, you know, after the thing had been going on for hours and hours and hours. There's no talk in here of why it took hours and hours and hours.
There's
next to no mention, Diane, of the number of people poisoned, what effects the poison are going to have on them.
Oh, you know, Bob, there's a precedent for what they should have done. I was living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, when that Ashland oil spill happened on the Monongahela.
Right.
You might remember that. And that CEO with his engineering background behaved differently, and it was a long time ago. And, you know, he came and faced the music and looked to me like he rolled up his sleeves. It looked to people in Pittsburgh like he rolled up his sleeves and started working on the problem and admitted to the fault, that the fault was in Ashland. But as I recall, the communities directly affected, and it was Floreet, is that how you pronounce? Floreet was upstream. Floreet, the Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Mostly older residents, you know how Pittsburgh.
Sure.
And they shut the water off to them.
Yeah.
I mean, they shut the water off, as I recall. There's precedent to how
there's no mention in this report whatsoever, Diane, of the fact that you've got possibly billions of dollars worth of damage, because they still don't have an answer for, I mean, water heaters, they still have that shit in them, okay? Pardon my dirty little mouth, but, and the water lines running through the house, absolutely. I got to share a little bit more with you, though, because it'll make you scream. I mean, Jesus, the response to this event highlighted the outstanding work of West Virginia's emergency responders and the West Virginia National Guard in protecting our citizens. No, it didn't. 300,000 people potentially got poisoned.
Mm.
How were they protected? the teamwork and, but wait, because I have a feeling you understand, you probably understand more than most of us do what bureaucratic weasel speak sounds like.
Well, I think a lot of us are getting big doses of it nowadays, yeah.
The teamwork and dedication of these individuals was exemplarity. That's the word, exemplarity, and should not go unnoticed. Even though these responders did an excellent job of dealing with the event once it occurred, and again I ask, how? It showed a better job could be done in identifying, planning, and collaborating. See, do you hear that? That's weasel speak,
yes.
Isn't it? In identifying, planning, and collaborating to protect the citizens of West Virginia. Not, I don't think the word coal appears in this report.
Yeah, and we all want to salute the flag by this point and all that. You know, the National Guard has been called out, and
And you know, the National Guard did a decent job of, you know, the water was trucked in and flown in, and they took it around to distribution points. Okay, yes, good job, first responder, members of the citizen militia, good job. But that's all after
the
fact.
That's not the story, is it? That's not the story.
No. Get this, okay? An important gap was current information on the location of storage facilities with potential contaminants and their relationship to water treatment facilities. Although some data existed, it was largely out of date.
Oh, my God.
Are you ready to run screaming into the night, Diane?
Well, the licorice smell was just a curiosity.
Well, I mean, downtown St. Louis used to smell like licorice when the Switzer factory was there now, didn't it? Licorice is a nice smell, isn't it?
I don't know. I guess one could try to think that way about it.
This thing is so freighted with, oh, my God, an important gap was current information on the location of storage facilities. Well, why did we have that gap? Could it be that we had that gap because we have a legislature that will let the chemical and coal industry do just about anything it damned well pleases as long as they promise us that they're being job creators? Isn't that why?
My student said that tank wasn't inspected for since, do you recall, Bob?
What? The
1987, I don't remember.
I was going to say the Reagan administration, yeah.
Yeah, and they said it was because it was, I can't remember now, I've seen so many cases
now. And back then when it was inspected because it was a storage holding facility for Pennzoil.
Uh-huh.
Not some little fly-by-night chemical operation being run by a guy who used to sell Coke.
Oh, yeah, they got into that. They thought it was, they got into that with a straight face, you know, that a criminal, was traceable to, directly traceable to a known criminal. They said that with a straight face, and by straight face, they took it very seriously. They thought that was reprehensible. They didn't think it was funny or anything, and it's not. And by the way, I brought up to them that thing about the water heaters, because I did learn that, to think about that by listening to you. And actually, that cartoon I just told you about was actually the next to the last slide. I'm now recalling that the last slide was them educating the class a bit, just a bit, on the battle for Blair Mountain. To say to the class, this can be put in some historical context. I thought that was good.
Very good indeed. Well, consider how they responded. I mentioned this a little bit ago. Consider how this report responds regarding methylchlorohexane methanol. The committee reports, the committee writes, one key issue that must be considered as we move forward is the large number and classification of chemicals that may impact our water systems. MCHM was not considered a toxic substance under current guidelines. And they quote the testimony before the House Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure by Mike Dorsey of the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, and we know exactly how much protecting the environment West Virginia DEP does.
Hmm.
He actually said,
yeah.
So grab hold of the hockey puck and listen to this quote, Diane. He said this to the Congress of the United States. An unusual issue with MCHM and PPH is their relative lack of toxicity. The problems that the release caused are very real, and there's no doubt that the do not use order was the right thing to do, but there's relatively little data on the chemicals. So, I mean, can we just play fun with logic with that for a minute? We have no data on the toxicity of the chemicals, therefore we think the chemicals aren't toxic.
Wow. Nice circle there. Well, okay, in this report, are there any action points? Are there any...
Yeah, they make recommendations.
Yeah. Do they make sense?
Let's see. Well, you're going to love this. Work Group 1 recommended as follows. A review and assessment of the effectiveness and the quality of information contained in updated source water protection plans required for certain public water systems by the provisions of Section 9, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Recommendation of Work Group 1, the very first sentence. At this time, there has not been any updated source water protection plans to review. The recommendation is made. Okay, so Work Group 2, a review and assessment of the effectiveness of legislation enacted during the 2014 regular session as it pertains to assisting public water systems in identifying and reacting or responding to identified potential sources of significant contamination and increasing public awareness and public participation in the emergency planning and response process. Recommendation of Work Group 2. Since the legislation has been in effect a relatively short period of time, the Commission was unable to assess the overall effectiveness of the legislation.
I'm having to find, I don't have a hockey puck anywhere near, but I'll have to find something here, Please continue.
this is a Pocket Fisherman commercial or Mr. Microphone, but wait, there's more. Work Group 3, the extent of available financing and funding alternatives which are available to existing public water systems to pursue projects which are designed to create alternate sources of supply or increased stability of supply in the event of a spill, release, or contamination event which impairs the water system's primary source of supply. In other words, how are we going to pay for all this? Right? Since the charge for this work group involves funding for projects, several of the funding agencies were invited to present a description of the types of funding their agency could provide and whether or not their programs currently have sufficient dollars which can be used for these types of projects. Discussion was held concerning the mechanisms for funding. It was agreed and decided that any loan dollars would have to be repaid by existing customers. In other words, they're going to hang it on the ratepayers.
Oh, I should have seen that coming.
Right. And Work Group 4, a review and consideration of the recommendations of the U.S. Chemical Safety and Hazard and Investigation Board after its investigation of the Bayer Crop Science incident of 2008, which was Bayer Crop Sciences was actually down there in Institute, West Virginia, making methyl isocyanate, the same thing that poisoned Bhopal, India. And we were minutes away from another Bhopal. Recommendation of Work Group 4. This work group, chaired by Dr. Rahul Gupta, has met and is working with other citizen groups and will have information available in the summer of 2015.
Mm.
Try not to spill anything till then.
I used to use the Bhopal as a case. It's a good case to call students' attention to many things, many hazards, but it's just so depressing.
Well, and so there was one. There's another work group, Work Group 5, you can just imagine this.
Oh, it might as well be a focus group or something, and then market it. Marketing focus groups.
Yeah, well, and that's why I thought, given your area of expertise, Diane, you would find interesting the way that this completely devolved into sort of a bureaucratic, Work Group 5, any recommendations or suggestions the study commission may offer to improve the infrastructure of existing public water systems to provide safe and reliable sources of supplies and to pursue other measures designed to protect the integrity of public water service. In other words, anybody else got, this is at the end of the meeting, where anybody else got anything else? Anybody? Okay. So, Work Group 5 says, discussion was held that it should not be the utility's responsibility to complete information gaps in MSDS sheets. DEP receives emergency plans from the owner-operator of the tanks upon review. If there's missing information, the person submitting the plan would be asked to provide information. You know, asked, not told, not compelled, not threatened with legal process. Just asked, and, you know, if you can get around to it, but if you can't, we understand, or maybe the dog ate it. We're not sure. A considerable discussion was held concerning the responsibility related to the accuracy of the material safety data sheets used by the utilities. Discussion concerning the incompleteness, lack of information concerning interaction with other chemicals and toxicology were considered. It was the consensus that this responsibility would not be placed on the owner-operator of the water system. An item of concern is whether the utility has an implied duty to complete information gaps, and to the extent there are information gaps, who should fill it on the MSDS? It was felt that the Secretary of DEP should have the authority to reject filings from facilities with incomplete data. In addition, discussions were held concerning the use of a nationally recognized group to review the toxicology information on sheets where information is either missing or inadequate. It was felt, because this is apparently all about feelings, it was felt that the manufacturer has the ultimate responsibility on providing complete information on products they have produced. And that's true.
Oh, my God.
Right? That's true. It is the manufacturer's responsibility. They're the ones putting it in the stream of commerce and, for all intents and purposes, into the Elk River stream as well. But do you, knowing what you've learned over the course of the time that you've been part of the Horn, do you think for an instant that the West Virginia legislature is going to compel chemical companies to let us know about the toxicity of every chemical that could conceivably become part of a disaster that could affect West Virginians? I mean, the line of lobbyists going out the Capitol doors to come in and say, well, these are proprietary processes directly related to our ability to make a dollar, and you're violating our God-given rights to profit. I mean, you can hear it, can't you, Diane?
Well, I mean, I just having a little thought experiment in my mind how this report might look if it were done within the context of strong and enforceable public policy, because that's what needs to happen. I mean, all systems have to have a check, a governor, you know, a governor in a technical sense, where there's feedback and adjustments. And for this, reports like this, to me, all this gobbledygook and pointing the finger and whimsical proposals. I mean, what would the report look like if there was a will to public policy, a history of public policy enforcement?
Or a state government whose entire history was not one of profound and abiding dysfunction?
Well, I think the lack of public policy is an artifact of what you just said. You know? I mean, that because of the culture, well, it's kind of circular, isn't it? Because of the culture, there's a lack of public policy, and the lack of public policy just feeds the dysfunction and leads to these situations. It's to me, most roads lead to public policy, and that's why when I survey a field that you know, where there's such negative sentiment against public policy ideologically, and not only that, no one wants it because everyone's got their hands in the till, then I'm just like, yeah, well, okay, you just, you know, what's left? You rely on self-control. Well, that's not working.
Isn't that what George Bush used to talk about in terms of industry self-regulating?
Well, that's the whole thing now, because in academia, like when public policy has fallen in some disrepute, then.
But let's be clear, and I'm not trying to interrupt Diane, but we need the marvelous coherence. When you talk about public policy being in disfavor, public policy is in disfavor because it is viewed as being at odds with unrestrained, rampant, predatory capitalism, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some people who might really buy into some argument that less leads to the greater good, and you have that utilitarian kind of argument. But I think for the most part, what makes it popular is because the people with the money will get more money if they can just do what they want. I mean, doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, and look, now Freedom Industries can't make money anymore because Freedom Industries' own greed in not taking care of their own infrastructure put them out of business. And that's why Gary Southern winds up having to scramble and lie to investigators and lie to the bankruptcy court, trying to keep his money from getting pulled in as a potential asset in a lawsuit.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure he was busy, you know, stuffing $100 bills into money belts and flying off for Cayman vacations and putting him, you know, God only knows how much money he's got squirreled away by now.
Right. And you know, in these situations, sometimes I get, despite my funny temperament, I get kind of jaded because I teach these kind of cases year after year because they're available. Like, it's more difficult to teach cases where there's something good that happens because they're not reported on, the facts have not, you know, it's more difficult for the students to find facts because everything's going okay. You know what I mean? So the cases available to teach from and hand to students are when something goes wrong. And we try to work our way to a vision of what the system should be like by looking at what went wrong and why. And in all these situations, as you know, there are enablers. I mean, so like with Arthur Anderson, with Enron, the enabler was Arthur Anderson, but it was also the board of directors. It was also the credit rating agencies and the accounting profession at large and SEC rules relaxed and on and on and on. So, you know, when you start looking, visually drawing a network of the enablers, just kind of gets, you can kind of project it on a larger screen of society. And you can just see why it leads to 2008 and the financial collapse. And
right. So, what do you expect to come of the little gift that was given to the Wall Street banks out of the Cromnibus?
Well, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, but I would say more of the same.
No, you don't have a crystal ball, Diane, but...
We don't need one.
Well, what you have is far more valuable. You have an ability to postulate executive conduct based upon evidence of past acts.
Well, and there are executives trying to do better. And there are associations trying to do better. But here's what I look at. You know, there's a model of moral reasoning that is pretty famous, and it's called Kohlberg's Levels of Moral Reasoning. It's about moral development, and it's about the cognitive, it's about the moral cognition available to us. Now, it has its detractors. The feminists mostly hate it for reasons I don't think it's worth going into. I mean, they have valid points, but I'm just going to refer to Kohlberg's theory because there's been a lot of empirical evidence built up around it, and it's well known, and it's developmental. And according to all the data that's built up around that theory, most of the time, reason on a conventional level of moral reasoning. And that conventional level means we are looking at the law for our boundary, and we're looking to others in our peer group for a boundary. So it's other-oriented. There's a higher stage, so to speak, available, which has to do with something else, social contract reasoning, reciprocity, universalistic humankind orientation, But according to that model, most of us reason most of the time looking at the boundary of our peer group and good, you know, approval and the law. So, you know, to get to something you just brought up, what can we see happening if this theory is right, if the evidence that is built up around it is right? what's going to happen when they dismantle part of the Dodd-Frank Act, when most people look to the law for a boundary, and even then they find ways around it, but where is the self-control? Where is the self-regulation that is touted? It's not going to be there.
Well, I think it's that self-regulation is off living on the unicorn farm, isn't it?
It's there for some, but it's that most of us are in bureaucracies and in organizations. So given that complex system, kind of loosely coupled system is how it's described, because there's many moving parts and it's hard to find cause effect and all that. Okay, we're looking to our peer group and professional codes, and we're looking to the law in a lot of the work we do in bureaucracies. When the law is relaxed, and then when professional codes kind of tumble, which many have, the accounting profession with Sarbanes-Oxley, the accounting profession lost its time-honored ability to self-regulate. That was a watershed mark. And, the accountants I know in colleges of business were just walking around with looking at the floor, their heads drooping. It was a bad day. So in this period of self-regulation and touting no need for government control, no need for laws, and not enough money for them anyway, well, what I see happening is predictable according to the theory of moral development with which I'm most familiar. And, we can see more with derivatives. We can see more bailouts. Has the president signed that? Has the Senate taken that up? Would you?
I am not exactly sure where the process
there it is. Yeah.
I was gonna put something out there for a future conversation, Diane, and who knows? This maybe it'll work into one of your projects with your students, because I find this next thing, and I talked about it some I think on Thursday. Actually, I talked about it extensively. I would love to hear your take on the Greenpeace fiasco.
Oh yeah.
Because I mean, now here you have a massive organization that operates in 26 countries, mm-hmm. which means that it has basically 26 branches, and so little oversight somewhere along the way that nobody was able to stop the organization from going up and doing profound and lasting damage to a world heritage site.
Yeah.
I think also I would be, if you want to read up on it or whatever, I think the other thing that I would find interesting would be your analysis. Not like I'm giving you homework. I feel kind of weird. but your analysis of the difference between a corporation, because when they get to this level, they're behaving corporately. You know what I mean?
The NGOs, yeah, there's been a lot written on that. They morph into something else,
And so they apologized for offending anybody by doing what they did.
Uh-huh.
But to this moment, Greenpeace has still not apologized for the actual, tangible, physical damage that they did. And overflights, they used drones, but overflights now appear to show that no, it was not just there and gone, that in fact you can still see the outline of some of the letters there. You can see where they moved and removed rocks. And I know it's been hard for a lot of people to get their minds around why I was so irritated, so infuriated by this. But among other things, I mean, I've seen people say, well, you know, erosion and rain and everything. I mean, you know, all these things. It doesn't rain there, Diane. And there's almost no wind at all. The Nazca people were not stupid. They chose their site for a reason.
Well, you should be angry, because even if there wasn't a lot of damage, and I'm sure there will be damage, God only knows if someone's going to measure it or estimate it, but they have, by their actions, they have broken with their founding mission and value statement. So there's a reason to be upset about that. Whether the damage is great or small, that's not a trustworthy NGO. And a lot of those NGOs, I mean, I was not really surprised when this was reported about Greenpeace, because a long time ago, this sociologist did a study of the Tennessee Valley Association, and it's like a classic study that shows how an organization can start out one way and over time morph into something completely different. So, like, I expect to find it, actually. But I would still, you know, but there's still some cachet to the name Greenpeace. So it was still a little jarring. It was still, it was jarring.
Yeah, and you know, I've known folks at Greenpeace, and they're not of the eco-aristocracy class. They're people who are dedicated and actively engaged in what they think is a noble cause and a noble pursuit, and they're concerned about climate change. But when you go and you stomp around on an environment and damage and to a certain extent destroy an environment in the name of saving the environment or saving the planet, and you know how I feel about that phrase, then you've just kind of put paid to your entire operating philosophy, haven't you?
And justify the means. Yeah, and I'm always trying to keep my eye at the top, because that's a failure of leadership and culture, and I'm always looking at the top. I'm not saying some rogue person in the organization can't do that, but I usually do not buy that.
Well, but that's my next question. You probably understand structure better than most of us do. So there's a worldwide executive director of Greenpeace, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he went to Peru to apologize for the offense, but of course not for the damage.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a worldwide executive director, and I guess, I'm guessing its structure here, and then there's a council of executive directors of the other 26 units. Wouldn't that make sense?
Kind of like a big
board.
They're called strategic business units usually, but with an NGO, that would make sense.
And then each individual unit, like, for instance, the United States is a unit. And
mm-hmm.
and the United States, apparently, the U.S. Greenpeace, you've got, and I've heard it from a number of different quarters, the U.S. Greenpeace folks are just, and to their credit, are sitting there with their heads in their hands. You were talking about the accountants walking around looking at the floor. They're doing that. And they're astonished that something like this could be allowed to happen.
Well, you know, that's how it goes, because I was teaching right after Tyco. Tyco almost went belly up around the same time as Enron. I was teaching a class elsewhere with two senior managers from Tyco in it who kind of took me aside before I started teaching their class. It's in the summer on the East Coast, and said, "We are so embarrassed about our affiliation. Please do not use Tyco as an example in the class. We'd really appreciate it." I said, "No problem. I've got lots of other examples I could point to." But, yeah, these people, middle and lower management, people on the ground, their identities are usually tied up with, for a lot of them, thinking they're doing something meaningful. You know, that's not surprising. And, yeah, I can imagine a lot of them are just demoralized about this.
But what fascinates me in this is that whatever the leadership structure is, somehow or another, and bear in mind, Greenpeace went to those, I mean, it's not like they just went and did this. They were active in a, they had an active, determined presence at the COP20 talks, okay? And they spent a lot of organizational money flying people to Lima, okay? And so there had to be, didn't there, strategy sessions of how are we going to do this, blah, 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 blah. You got 20 people from 7 countries.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you had, and I know it's not popular to talk about this way, but if you had stern top-down leadership, would this be less likely to happen than if you had some sort of amorphous semi-chaos theory, everybody's going to hold hands and sing kumbaya and come to consensus leadership model?
Well, to me, you know, leadership matters. And top-down controls and how the culture is shaped in that regard matters. But what concerns me about NGOs is that it's the same thing that concerns me about corporations. It's just like John Kenneth Galbraith, who I had the pleasure of meeting in Stockholm once. That's another story. But he spoke of countervailing power. Corporations should have the countervailing power of unions and governments, public policy, and NGOs should have some kind of countervailing power, or what happens when they're just left alone with autonomy, what happens is what the picture you just painted. So leadership matters, but countervailing power from the outside, whether it's other activist groups pressuring Greenpeace to act differently, whether it's funds drying up, whether it's public policy that keeps an eye on these NGOs, these civil society organizations, to me, everything has to be held in check. You see what I mean?
Yes.
And NGOs can just morph on their merry way. There's not a lot of countervailing power.
They're out there on their own.
Yes.
Sitting
yes.
on top of millions and millions
yes.
of dollars.
Yes. And do they have, they do have a board of directors, of course. But they don't even have the possibility of a.
But the board But the board of directors is more often than not comprised of people. You know, board of directors positions in NGOs and nonprofits. Board of director membership is a reward for having written them a really big check.
Yeah, or someone who wants a legacy. Yeah, and so they don't even have the possibility of the stockholders getting unhappy and fund managers moving in. You know what, Bob? I'm aware that we're about
yeah, you're watching
time.
The clock. Well,
yeah,
I think this is a fascinating potential.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Look what we've ended up. My God. But may I just suggest that you do indeed send me that report, because I have the email of the four young men who did the Freedom Industries case, and they would be happy to receive that report.
Oh, I will do it. I will do it the minute the program closes.
Oh, good. And yeah. I'll send it to them, and they'll be glad to have it, because these students, sometimes their thoughts are changed by getting their hands in the case like this. And, Bob, next time I have the pleasure of speaking with you. I wanna tell you that I just found out I have Scottish Irish heritage in my genealogy, which I didn't even know about. So I just wanna compare notes with you on that.
Oh, you're part of the old sod.
I'm talking Duncan Robertson. I mean, I'm talking about something my mom at Thanksgiving dinner popped up and said, Diane, did you know that I found out through genealogy, I found that we have Scottish, that you and I have Scottish-Irish heritage through this line, and she sent me all the documents, which I've been trying to pour through. Alabama is mentioned.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
As in mine.
Well, I have just now emailed the report to you, so
okay.
I'll be interested in their thoughts. Diane, thank you for a lovely conversation.
Oh, fun. Okay, thanks, Bob.
Have a great
Bye-bye.
Evening. Bye now.
Yeah.
The marvelously coherent Diane from Kansas, Stan. I learn something new, you know, each and every time that we talk. And I feel like I have a better understanding of why some of these things that we go, why do they happen? I want to thank Sal. Thank you, Sal. Sal is the only individual this evening responding to Steve's generous offer to double whatever came in up to $75. Thank you, Sal. And I don't know if Steve's going to want to keep the challenge on the table or not. So thank you. Thank you very much, Sal. We will enter the program. I don't know if we'll be on level ground, but, not quite a hole yet, but darn well working on it. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you. Thank you, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy, moderators in the Horn chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan and Carol Baker. Thank you, John Fox. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT, ACHEACT.org, and always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.